Hi, this is author, podcaster, musician Paul Myers, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room to promote the release of his new book, John Candy, A Life in Comedy, please welcome author and host of the Record Store Day podcast, Paul Myers. How you doing, Paul?
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Now, where are you right now, Paul? I'm in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Where is Paul Myers?
Right now, I'm in the Kensington, California, which is just north of Berkeley. And in fact, I'm four blocks away from John Fogerty's childhood home.
Oh, that's it.
You can see the paddle wheel steamers from here. Yes.
That's a great bit of trivia. Now people are going to be able to narrow down where to find you to get their book signed.
And everyone knows his childhood home is in Sausalito. It's in Wisconsin. Okay.
There you go. Originally from Canada, how long have you made your home in California?
On and off since 97. I moved from Toronto with my wife, who's also Canadian, and we both had work visas in 97. And then we stayed here till about 2001. And then we went to Vancouver, Canada for 5 years because various job things were changing. And then Lisa got another job in California, and we thought this time we're going to make it stick. So we got visas, we got the H-1, we got the green card, and then we actually went for the full citizenship somewhere in the middle of the Obama administration. So we're dual citizens.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we're glad to have you. This book, John Candy, A Life in Comedy, I actually have a couple copies to give away from the publisher in conjunction with this episode. Who was the most important or helpful resource to you in writing this book?
I'd say there are three. First, I had access to John Candy's longtime assistant, Robert Crane Jr., who not only was a journalist who got his job with John Candy by writing about him and got to know him doing interviews for, of all people, We Magazine, Penthouse Magazine, and Playboy. So he had a certain genre that he was writing for, but he would write the features. You know, people buy those magazines just for the articles, right?
Sure.
And so he became really good pals with Candy to the point where Candy recognized he was an insider. He could be an insider who could work the media from the other end and make sure his schedule was, you know, straight. So he basically was a companion for many years. And to my surprise, very agreeable to give me lots of behind the scenes information, but also he let me have his archive of articles. So we have these contemporaneous interviews with John Candy that I wouldn't have been able to get, obviously. And so that's like a big one. And the other one is Tracy J. Morgan, a fan from England who had written a self-published book called Searching for Candy. And in that, she interviewed people that had passed away since the time she did that. And like one of them was Carl Reiner. So I could get access to Carl Reiner's comments on John Candy and a couple of other people who worked on various movies of his that she tracked down. And I interviewed her as well to get an overview. And so those two people were especially important to me. And Dan Aykroyd, of course, giving me hours of information plus writing the foreword. So that was great.
And of course, Carl Reiner directed John in Summer Rental. And since you brought up Dan Aykroyd, I was going to ask you, with all the people you have access to, why Dan Aykroyd? Why did you pick Dan to write the foreword?
Well, it actually makes sense when you read the book. John Candy, if I can go into the story a little bit. Just
of course.
John Candy, okay, so John Candy is a Toronto actor at this point in his 1970s, early 70s. And he's just another Toronto actor, hasn't really thought about doing comedy, but he's friends with a bunch of musical theater people, including the Toronto cast of Godspell, featuring Martin Short, Eugene Levy, and Andrea Martin. But also these two actors from Ottawa, Canada, who just moved to Toronto, Valerie Bronfield and Dan Aykroyd. There's an announcement in 73 that they're going to start the Toronto Second City cast of the Chicago Second City. So they wanted to do the Toronto cast with Toronto-based actors. So everyone's going for the audition. John Candy's not interested. But Aykroyd and Valerie Bromfield say, just come with us and we'll go have lunch afterwards. You can sit in the back and wait for us and we'll all go eat something. You know, we'll go get ribs or something or whatever. And then to Candy's surprise, which is verified by three different accounts, they had snuck his name onto the audition list. And at this audition, there was a great comedy impresario from Chicago named Del Close. And comedy history nerds like me know the name Del Close because he launched the careers of so many people in Chicago. So what happened was the Toronto cast didn't feel that John Candy was ready, but they all liked him, but they didn't know what to do with him. And Close says, I'll take him back to Chicago and make a man out of him. You know, I'll teach him, go to boot camp, basically. And he puts him in the cast of Second City Chicago, you know, first time he's ever been outside of a Canadian city, and it's Chicago of all places. So it's great. And in the cast with him is a young Bill Murray, who is just starting out. And they learn the ropes of comedy together, but they also, you know, Murray shows Candy Chicago and shows him the sights. And anyway, so that's Aykroyd's first big act, as he gets him in the movie. He gets him in the show, I mean. And then they are going to Chicago they're going to Los Angeles together at one point to open the Second City Los Angeles. It for both of them never really happens there, but the road trip there, Aykroyd shares with me this incredible story of just the two of them driving. It's a movie in itself. Like, yes. The two of them driving from Toronto down to Pasadena. And in, you know, Aykroyd describes the songs they listened to, the things they did, the motels. And so that's the second thing I see, the bonding of Aykroyd. And of course, as they start, they did Second City stage together for a short time, but Aykroyd ends up getting the call to go to Saturday Night Live. Then when Second City Television gets on the air, they're all fans of each other's work. And then it takes a while. And then Stripes, they're in Stripes together. Excuse me.
Blues Brothers?
1941. I mean, I was thinking war movies.
That's so okay.
There's a whole story about how that happens in the book. But cutting to the chase here to stick with Aykroyd. So they're suddenly cast in 1941, Steven Spielberg's only comedy. And there's a reason. So they're working together. Then he writes him up. Aykroyd writes him into the Blues Brothers and gives him a really great, what they say, real estate, you know, really great moment in the film, the orange whip scene.
Who wants an orange whip? Orange whip? Orange whip? Three orange whips.
And then, you know, all through it, he tries to get him in Ghostbusters. They have a difference of opinion about how to play this character, Lewis Tully. So it ends up going, and Aykroyd, and Candy recommends Rick Moranis. So that's another thing. So they have this whole thing where they're friends all the way through. They do The Great Outdoors.
One, two, three. One, two, three.
But then what really sealed it for me about Aykroyd was that when Candy dies, there's two funerals, one in Los Angeles and one in Toronto. And the Los Angeles funeral, everybody I interviewed said that the sort of best speaker that day was Dan Aykroyd. And he gave this beautiful speech that was almost a Roman emperor speech. It was Shakespearean in places, and it was just talked about Candy, and it summed up the life of John Candy in beautiful poetic terms, but also funny. And he killed them at the funeral, so to speak. And it was such a big moment. And then after I had all this stuff written, I was thinking, oh, I'd love to get some cool person to do the foreword, you know, like, so Seth Meyers did the foreword for my Kids in the Hall book, right? Which was such a great tying it all together, because Seth Meyers, it turns out, had a huge admiration for the Kids in the Hall. So I wanted somebody for this. And, you know, there's a lot of obvious names you could have gone with. And then I went, wait a minute, if Dan Aykroyd wants to do it, he's already been so generous, but it seems to me like he's the steward of John Candy's journey to me. So I sent an email to his publicist or his manager, Susie, and I said, I know you've been really generous. Dan's been really generous, but if he could just do the foreword, I didn't hear a damn thing for a week and a half. I thought, oh, they've just rejected this. I've gone too far. I've pushed it. Expecting to get a, no, he's too busy. All of a sudden, the next email I get from their camp is just the foreword. It's written. Dan wrote this. That's what it said. Wow. Dan wrote this, and it was a PDF of a Dan Aykroyd letter that he'd written himself. And it's very similar to the eulogy. He summed up some of the themes, but it was beautiful. And I just thought, you know, I haven't spoken to him in person since we did our interviews and since he sent this forward. And so, you know, at some point I'd like to run into him again and just thank him, buy him whatever he's drinking, probably one of his own skull vodkas. And, but like, I learned so much about Dan Aykroyd during this process, by the way. I could write a whole other book, but that's why Dan Aykroyd did the foreword. Long story. Thank you for listening.
Well, a long and entertaining story. And one of the things I loved about this book, and you called yourself a comedy nerd, I'm also a comedy nerd. When you're reading about the early days of John Candy and you're reading all these names that we know now, I mean, back then they don't know that they're going to be famous or rich or successful or anything. And it's so cool to, as I read this book, I was putting myself like in the room with those people and how just amazing that must have been, you know, as they were coming up and creating. It's so cool. I love that part of the book, the early years.
You get a sense of this sort of thing that you're speaking of when you Tom Hanks was a great interview for this book. And just for one thing, to get on the phone with Tom Hanks and go, Tom Hanks here. What can I tell you about John Candy? You know, it's like he's so Tom Hanks. And then he tells this story about the period he was in when he made Splash with John Candy.
One fine day, love came for me, and love was rare as love can be. I saw stars shining in clear blue skies. We flow together once and forever. Love came for me.
So you got to remember, Tom Hanks was getting his first time to really be the romantic lead in something. He'd been in Bosom Buddies, a sitcom with Peter Scolari. During the time that they were doing that, Scolari and him were big fans of SCTV and would tape the show because they might have been out or something. So they would VHS or whatever it was, maybe even beta the show, and they would share the tapes and, you know, they would talk about SCTV. So they were big fans of SCTV. Yeah. And they and Hanks wasn't a big star, a huge star yet. And also Ron Howard hadn't really defined himself as a director in the big way, commercial way. So this is all happening when they cast John Candy in it, and it's kind of a weird casting. Everyone agrees it was the weirdest thing to cast Hanks and Candy as brothers. But Hanks remembers the table read and being at the table read with Eugene Levy as well. And just, you know, it was at Ron Howard's house. And it was like all knew, and he couldn't, and Hanks couldn't believe he was in the room with the guys who had made him laugh on SCTV. And you think about that now, you know, like they all became legends. And then it's just, to me, that's I kept reminding myself that, yeah, when Aykroyd was, you know, hanging out with him back in the day, they were just two people trying to do stuff together, you know, and they were both salesmen when they first met. They both had day jobs, you know, so it's kind of an interesting, I think that's an awesome thing. I love stories like that, by the way. Yeah. I love stories of communities and scenes, you know, like where a bunch of talented people who just happen to get together, those rockets, you know, moments where everything just explodes together. And I also love the idea that nobody knows they're famous until one day they wake up famous. You know, like it's such a neat thing.
Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara, they're as viable today as they've ever been. They're always popping up in stuff still.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, no, that's something the SCTV cast, even back in the stage days, they all learned how to do improv together. And they all learned a similar style together that they all created together. So they had a voice and a rhythm together that is sort of like a great jazz band. Like they all know how to improvise together, but they also know how to lay out and let the other people solo. And they kind of listen to each other, and they have a very cooperative approach to comedy and ensemble comedy that you don't get from, you know, if they had been cast in a machine, like if there'd been like open auditions for Second City Television and they got people from all over the place, it might not be the same because they would not have grown up together, you know? Right. So I think that there's something organic about that whole generation of comedians that came out of this one area, you know?
They kind of had a secondhand language all their own with each other. They just, they knew each other personally. So that would have to come out on stage at some point.
Yeah.
So speaking of, let's get a Tom Hanks connection here. The documentary, John Candy, I Like Me, is directed by Colin Hanks. This is released almost exactly at the time that the book comes out. Is this just a happy coincidence?
It is. It is. There's a lot of things that are happy. Well, for one thing, Colin Hanks was a little kid on the set of Splash. So that's kind of an interesting detail, by the way. And I think I even have a mention of him from Tom Hanks.
Yes.
So here's the chronology of the book. And everyone, no one can believe it, but there's a really happy ending to this story. First, about 4 years ago, I'd done the Kids in the Hall book, and I said to my editor, they said, what do you want to do next? And I thought, oh, it's nice that they're offering me another book. So that's first victory. And then I said, you know, I think on the theme of Canadian sketch comedy, I should do a book about Second City Television. And I said, but at the time, you got to remember, Martin Scorsese had just done this documentary. It was in the can, and then we thought, oh, it's going to come out, and it never did come out. But in the meantime, I said, you know, I don't know if I should do SCTV because I feel like it's going to be done by the time I finish this book. My editor says, Doug Richmond at House of Anansi, he says, why don't you do John Candy from SCTV and then you can talk about all the movies? And I was like, light bulb. Okay, of course, that's the thing. That's what we should do. So 4 years ago-ish, maybe 3.5, maybe 4 years ago, we decide to do the book about John Candy. And then first call I always make is to whoever I can, who's on the inside closest. So I emailed Jennifer Candy Sullivan, who is the daughter of John Candy and brother of Chris Candy and daughter of Rose Candy, John's widow. I say, listen, I'm doing this book. I want you to know I'm an honest dealer. I'm going to write a no agenda book. It's just a really, you know, tribute to your dad. And I'd love it if you'd be involved. And I've done this. I've done this. I've done this. I'm an accomplished writer or established or whatever. And she said, oh, no, we know who you are. We know you're Mike's brother from Second City. And we know that you've done really, you know, cool work. And, you know, so it was really nice. And then she said, but we're not going to participate because we're making our own movie. That's all she said. We're making our own documentary. And I said, well, that's great. And I'm thinking, that's going to be interesting. Now, I wonder if we could work together. But I never got to that point because I just sort of said, well, thank you for the blessing and good luck with your project. And we'll see you on the road somewhere. And I thought, well, that's them out for first person interviews. I'll have to get them from secondary sources. Then about 7 months later, I hear Ryan Reynolds making public announcements that he's interested in making a documentary. He's putting it together. And I thought, okay, he's working with the Candy family. So I send a note to them, and there's, you know, for some various reasons, the company doesn't want to hear from me, so they never even get it to Ryan. So Ryan isn't going to be involved, And then I hear Colin Hanks is directing, and I've liked his films before. I loved his film about Tower Records, All Things Must Pass, the story of yeah. Tower Records. And I loved his film about the very terrible shooting at the Bataclan in France with the Eagles of Death Metal. So he's made some great documentaries. I couldn't get him either, so I figured, okay, this is what they're doing. They know that I'm writing a book, and they don't want to have any intellectual property crossover. So we're both going to make the thing we make. I'm going to write the book I write. They're going to make the movie they make. We lock in on a date. October 7th, 2025 is going to be our publication date. 2 months after that, we hear an announcement that their film will go to Amazon on October 10th, 3 days after my book. So at this point, I'm also sending notes to the company again, Maximum Effort. And I'm saying, listen, obviously we're all locked on both of our projects. If Ryan wants to do something, like if you want to be, I think at one point he was mooted as a foreword or an afterword or something like that. And it's still nothing. But book comes out. They're doing a book tour, a film tour for their film where they have guests every night. The day before my book tour was October 14th, starting in Edmonton, Canada. The day before that, there was a date in Boston. And 3 days before that, Ryan Reynolds calls me. He calls me after not speaking, like I never heard from him at all. And he's super friendly and he's super deferential and he loves the book and he's excited. And he's like, you should come to Boston. We'll fly you in. And I said, well, I have to be in Edmonton October 14th, which is like, that means I'm doing your show October 13th. And somehow making it to Edmonton, I just can't miss the beginning of my own tour because it's a ticketed event. I don't know why I make trouble for myself. I should have just said yes, but I was being practical. I was like, right. I don't want to just, yes, sir. But we go and we do this event in Boston. He takes care of all the flights and everything. It's amazing. I'll cut to the chase that I did make it to Edmonton. I did. It was great. But the beautiful thing was this event in Boston on October 13th was at the Schubert Theater. And a good friend and someone who I've worked with before, Dan Pasternak, was the host interviewing us on stage. So he interviewed me first, then Ryan comes out and me and Ryan and Dan talk. And then they bring out Stephen Page from the Bare Naked Ladies. The wow. first book Perfect. I ever wrote was the yeah. Bare Naked Ladies authorized biography. And he's a good friend and one of my favorite musicians and songwriters. I love his singing completely. So he comes out and he sings a song that Ryan wants him to sing about, like that he wants to dedicate to John Candy. Then we all sing a song together, If I Had $1 Million, which was a Bare Naked Ladies big song, big sing-along.
If I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a house.
I would buy you a house.
And if I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
buy you furniture for your house.
Maybe a nice Chesterfield or an ottoman.
And if I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a K car,
a nice Reliant automobile.
And if I had $1 million,
I'd buy you.
That was such an incredible blessing upon the entire thing that suddenly the two projects had come together.
Yeah.
And then there's a big PS to this. It's like last week sometime, I'm opening my phone and there's like social media tags that Ryan Reynolds has written a 3-paragraph endorsement of my book, saying the most beautiful things that my own parents, God bless their souls, my own parents never said such nice things about me. So not only is there like a huge PS that we're on the same team, he apparently is a fan of my book and has my lifelong admiration for this act of generosity. So I do love you have to tell the beginning of that story to get to the happy ending.
Yes,
it's just one
sure.
of those things. But it's such a great story that has just unfolded in the last week, So I'm very excited about, and it's in service of John Candy. I have to say that the reason all of this seems to happen is because this isn't a book about my ego or Ryan and Colin's ego. This is a book about us honoring somebody who needs to be honored. And I think this year we both have honored John Candy in our own way and in our own mediums, So that's, I'll stop talking now, but I got very excited. I get very excited telling that story.
Of course. Yeah. Look, this is your project. This is your work. Okay. So what was I going to say now? Now I'm stumped. No. So this book, I watched the documentary first because it's less time consuming to watch the doc and I'm a slow reader. But after the doc, I wanted to read your book even more. I'm like, oh, now I want to know more, you know, because, you know, a documentary can't have everything and a book can't have everything. So the two things together, you get such a great overview of the man, John Candy, and it's just terrific.
Thank you.
I have a question about the book. No pictures in the book.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, there was a point where I realized the film was coming out. Okay. And I couldn't decide on, there's a whole bunch of reasons. There's a lot of photographs that I probably couldn't afford to license, to be honest, okay. If you want to get right to the practical. But then there's also just like, how do you sum it up with one or two pictures? And then it was kind of an assignment I made myself, and I don't talk about this very often, but I wanted to see if I could make the movie in my head with the words I'm using on the page. I wanted to see the old school, you know, if you want to get a picture of a guy, I'm going to give you a picture in words. And, you know, photograph sections are great. It's sort of like photograph sections and index sections are the, everybody goes to those first, and you just think, yeah, I want to see who they mention, and I want to see if there's photographs of, you know, famous people or baby pictures. And you know, I'm not saying I'm against it on every project, but for this one, it seemed like the real challenge, knowing also that people will have, I knew that the film was going to come out at some point, and that all this footage, you know, of this man in action would be out there. And I guess I kind of thought, well, this is kind of neat, because then it solves several issues at once. I can just write knowing that this is going to be a story, and yeah, and then there's no photos in it, but you know, who knows? I mean, somewhere down the line there might be a deluxe edition with an entire coffee table full of notes, you know, and photographs, but I don't know. It just, so it's definitely something that we thought about, you know, thought about a lot, and it wasn't a casual mistake like, oh no, we forgot to put pictures. There was a moment where I remember floating it to my editor and thinking, will they buy this? Like, will they say, no, you got to have pictures? But they, to credit of House of Anansi, they've been all in on this project. Doug Richmond, my editor there, has been nothing but supportive and kind of insightful about his notes and shaping what the project is and what it isn't. So every step of the way, when I consulted him about how about we do this, he would, in some cases, things did get changed. He would say, oh no, you need to do that, or don't do this so much. But a lot of times he was very agreeable and said, oh, I see what you're doing. Yeah, that's a good idea. So.
Well, I mean, the book does not need photos. I was just curious as to why not. But I will say this photo on the cover is spectacular. It encompasses John Candy. You look at it and you get the feeling and the essence of who and what John Candy is.
It's the twinkle in his eyes, right?
Yeah, it really is. And how many photos did you have to choose from in order to pick this one photo?
About seven that made the list that I saw. Ron Galella took that photograph, and Ron Galella was a famous paparazzi. Ron Galella is, some of his pictures were pictures that people didn't want taken, frankly, but he would photograph celebrities, and he got this moment where John Candy's eyes were twinkling and he had that quiet look of confidence and a little bit of bemusement, and something about his, we realized that John Candy's face is the focus of so many people's memories of him. You know, The first time Uncle Buck extends a hand in the movie Uncle Buck, the first time he introduces himself to Steve Martin in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
I never did introduce myself. Del Griffith, American Light and Fixture, Director of Sales, Shower Curtain Ring Division. Over here. I sell shower curtain rings. Best in the world. And you are?
Neil Page.
Neil Page. Pleased to meet you, Neil Page. So what do you do for a living, Neil Page?
Marketing.
Marketing. Super. Super. Fabulous. Isn't that nice?
Look, I don't want to be rude, but I'm not much of a conversationalist, and I'd really like to finish this article. A friend of mine wrote it, so...
Don't let me stand in your way. Please don't let me stand in your way. The last thing I want to be remembered as is an annoying blabbermouth. You know, nothing grinds my gears worse than some chowderhead who doesn't know when to keep his big trap shut. You catch me running off of the mouth, just give me a poke in the chops. Oh, feels good. Oh, God, I'm telling you. My dogs are barking today. Whew. Oh. That feels better.
Or just him as Johnny LaRue in SCTV. And so his face needed to be the cover. The book talks a lot about body shaming, so there was a sense that I wanted it to be about his face and not about his frame. But I will also give credit to the art department at House of Anansi for making all of the final decisions about aesthetics. And really all I had to do was say, oh, that's great. Or a couple of times I did make a suggestion. You know, we used pink typeface on the cover. Yeah. And I remember, not for any kind of reactionary reason, but I said, have we chosen the right color? Because he owned the Toronto Argonauts, whose color was blue famously, and is blue to this day, the double blue they called them. And I thought, wouldn't it be good if it was blue? And then they floated it around the art department and they said, no, you know, pink really works. And then I said, you know, it does. Yeah, it does. I was just asking. Sometimes you just ask to sort of see if we've exhausted all the options.
You want to make sure.
But they did a great job. The designers, and the designer's name escapes me, but it's listed inside the credits. But she's done a great job.
Alicia Shuchuk?
That's right. Alicia Shuchuk, who I can't remember if I met. I think she was not in the office the day I went in. I visited Toronto recently, but it was after hours kind of, so not a lot of people were there. But I remember saying, make sure you leave a note on her desk.
And there's also a picture of you here. And how did the photographer get their job that took your photo?
She married me.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, I
knew.
The book flap. Yeah, the book flap was taken by Lisa Algar, who is a professional home organizer in the Bay Area and is one of the best. So
excellent, excellent. A couple weeks ago, I had Bill Janovitz on my show, and I know you've also had him on your
show.
He's
a good friend too. He's a good friend. Yeah,
to discuss the Cars book. At that time on my show, he told me that there's no money in writing books. Now, after writing quite a few books, is that also your experience?
Yeah, I would say so. I would say, you know, people think, you know, like this book, for instance, not to brag, is a bestseller in Canada, and it's selling very well in the United States. I'll be lucky if it, you know, the amount of work you put in, it's not justified in dollar hours. You know, like it's really, you do it. I think if there's any money to be made, quite often it's in documentaries and other things that are, you know, ancillary things, projects that tie in. And as your profile increases, you get maybe more work, you know, and gigs. You know, it's, you know, I still do the Record Store Day podcast every week. You know, and that's a sort of a regular paycheck, and those aren't huge gigs either. But it's just a matter of, you know, when you freelance, you do a lot of gigs,
right.
And they might not all pay a lot, but you get your nest egg out of that, you know. But yeah, Bill's right. I mean, look at what Bill does. He wrote this huge Leon Russell book. It was a bestseller, and he wrote this huge Cars book, which I think is also a bestseller.
Yeah.
And he puts in all those hours and all that time and all that research. And, you know, he's out there with Buffalo Tom still playing, you know, so I think he's got another job. I think he's in real estate or something.
Yeah,
like
that. That's what he said. Yep.
So, and I know a lot of people in the arts who are also real estate people. And, you know, actually one of the keyboard saxophone player in Todd Rundgren's band I just spoke to, and he's a home appraiser. That's his, when he's not on the road, he's a home appraiser. Like, that's kind of how you do it. So, the sad truth.
Yeah,
you know,
when I interviewed Fee Wabel, he told me that he would manage commercial real estate. I mean,
yeah,
everyone that you think is a millionaire living in a castle is not. So
no. If anything, they're subletting the castle. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
I haven't said yet that this is such a fun read and that I love it. So I just want to.
Well, thank you for saying that. No, that's I never tire of hearing that. And, you know, you write these books alone, and as we've just established, for very little money. And the best you can hope for is that you reach people with the words. And it sounds really hokey maybe when I say it out loud, but there's nothing like that feeling. And I got to say, Robert Crane Jr., who I mentioned earlier, sent me the most lovely email because he did work very closely with him. And he said, the phrase, I'm paraphrasing, but the thing that stuck out to me is he said, you nailed it, brother, you know, brother, which I mean, to me, that means he's sort of, I can read between the lines. He's sort of welcomed me into the inside a little bit and saying, you captured my friend, John, and you got the essence of it. And that to me means a lot. You know, I'm sort of dying to hear what like Catherine O'Hara thinks, you know, like, well, I mean, I hope. And right. Certainly Dan Aykroyd, I would love to hear what he thinks. It's early days. The book's only been out about a month. So I'm sure in the new year we'll hear from people or I can seek them out. I don't know. I don't want to push it, you know.
Well, hopefully this book will be under a lot of Christmas trees in about a month. That would be
I hope so too.
Yeah.
And we're going to be doing more. We just did a small date, a small number of dates promoting it, which were all great. Toronto, New York, some in the Western Canada and Bay Area here, of course, because I live here. And we're hoping to do like some of the places that we didn't get to last time in the new year. Various writers' festivals, Los Angeles and Vancouver, Canada, and maybe Chicago. I'd like to go to Minneapolis is asking. So yeah, there's a lot of places like Nashville I'd like to go to. Surprisingly, so many cool people in Nashville have been asking about this. So you know, I'd like to tour out more.
Yeah, I mean, an event at Second City in Chicago sounds like a no-brainer.
It does. And I think I should do that. Yeah. I've been to Second Cities in Toronto and Brooklyn, New York on this last tour. So
yeah,
definitely Second City kind of taught him everything he knows. So yeah.
Now, Paul, are you going to sneak into some bookstores and sign the books that are on the shelf and put them back in there? Are you going to do any of that?
Well, yeah, I don't sneak though. I go right up to the front desk and I say with my ID out and I say, I'm the author of this book. You know, and if you've got any back stock, I'll sign it now. And so I just did that in Emeryville, which is near Oakland. I walked into a Barnes and Noble and I just said, you know, and I signed like 14 copies and I've done that. I did it in New York. I went all over Manhattan on the subway, just walking into stores that I had called ahead.
Okay.
Because you don't want to do it. Yeah. I went up to 112th Street and I, a place called Book Culture, and I just walked in and what I love about bookstores too is you think it's going to be like embarrassing or weird, but almost every bookstore person is super nice and really appreciates the author coming in. And of course, once you sign it, they can put a sticker on it, which means they suddenly have a little bit more of a special book to put in the front rack.
Yep.
And so it's a fun way to meet the people who sell the books. And I do want to tell people, you can use all the delivery systems you want, but your local independent bookstore is there for you 24/7. And if you support them, they'll support you because it's a place, it's a community hub. It's a place to buy books. It's a place to talk about books. It's a place to see authors speaking. And those people who have dedicated their lives to making, you know, bookstores, they're much like all of us. They're not doing this to make a living. They're not doing this to get rich. They might be making a living, but so there's a labor of love involved in even running a bookstore. So I support my local independent bookstores. That's
excellent.
All.
And so do I. Now, when you write a book like this, do you conduct and compile all the interviews first and then start writing, or are you writing while you're doing the research?
Oh, absolutely. I cannot write until I feel like I've got enough research to, this gets back to what I was saying when I told Jennifer Candy, you know, I don't have an agenda, and you don't have an agenda. And, you know, like any good detective will tell you, if you go in with a motive, if you go in trying to solve a crime in reverse, it doesn't work. You can't say, we know this guy did it, therefore we have to find all the clues. It has to be, what is the scene telling us? What is the information telling us? And the information will tell you stuff, and you start to see a pattern. And then you also have to weigh it in your own, you know, you chew it up. Like in my case, I'm a comedy nerd, like we've established, and I've followed a lot of comedy stories, and you start to see patterns, and you start to ask the questions during the interviews. You're also asking these questions, and you start to see patterns emerge, and you start to realize there's a likely thing that you have a certain idea. I have a framework that's on my board. This board behind me is changing all the time, and I will have a framework of chapter headings that sort of has the loose narrative of where chronologically the story's going. You can only really write the book after you've had most of that stuff done. You know, then you get late interviews. Sometimes you realize you need somebody and you go get them. Or you look for them if they're passed away. You have to look for, you know, through archives and stuff. And it's fun. It's hard work. There are long, long days involved, but it's kind of rewarding. There's something rewarding about when you get that interview where somebody tells you the thing that you hoped they would tell you or clarifies something for you that you didn't know. Like just talking to even Howard Deutsch, the director of Pretty in Pink, but also directed The Great Outdoors.
Yes.
I never thought I'd be talking to Howie Deutsch. And all of a sudden he's telling me great stories about working on the set. And the same with Tarkin Gotch, who worked for John Hughes, and James Hughes talking to me. And like, they're giving me details about certain things that I didn't know. And I feel so lucky to be speaking to the person themselves, you know, or Chris Columbus, the director of Home Alone, who also did Only the Lonely, telling me the firsthand story of directing these films with Candy in them. And, you know, and they're always so nice. A lot of them, most of them are really nice. If they've agreed to do an interview, I'm assuming they're going to be nice, you know?
Right.
So yeah.
And they like discussing their work too. Everyone likes to talk about things that they've done. How long did it take from the time you decide to write this book until you turn it in and it's finished? How long? What's the process?
Oh, well, the turning it in. So for one thing, the book was almost ready a year ago. So okay. We pushed the release date out a year because there was like one of those late interviews that I thought I needed. And I just said, you know, I'd rather not rush it to get it out and have it not be right. I want to make sure we can make a fourth draft. So, but the actual drafts took about 2 years, you know, so the research is probably the first 2 years and then a year and a half to get to the third draft. And then I did a final comb that was the tightest draft, which is the one you're getting now. And so, yeah, so it takes a long time, you know.
And is your wife the first one to read the drafts before anyone else?
Sometimes and sometimes not. Sometimes she prefers to see it after it's been edited so that she can, you know. Sometimes I will read something to her. This is going to sound corny, but sometimes I'll write something that kind of makes me almost cry with how well I felt it. Like, you know, sure. it's like this sings for me is the phrase I use. It sings for me and I just can't wait. So I'll walk into whatever she's doing and it's, you know, I don't really ask her. And I walk in and I say, can I read you the paragraph where I describe the last scene, the last day of this movie? And I do, or the last chapter, the last line in the chapter that sets up the next chapter. And I feel like, oh, I got it. And she'll share in the excitement of that, you know, or sometimes
what if she doesn't give you what you want? What if you think this is fantastic? And then she's like, I don't know, Paul.
Well, it's hard, but that has happened on occasion where I'll say something in a very clumsy way that I think is, I try to force it to work. And she goes, you might want to take out that little bit there. That feels like it slows down the thing. And I go, yeah, you're right. You know, like it's not, you know, you appreciate having the honesty and you appreciate also the fact that every editor, by the way, mostly will tell you something that's going to make you look smarter. So hopefully, like when Doug Richmond, my editor, sends me back a draft and says, this part goes on too long. I'm like, okay, well, I thought it was essential. And he'll say, no, you established this already. So now you're just being redundant. And I'll go, oh yeah. And then I think, wow, so no one's ever going to see the clumsy draft now because now it's being fixed, you know? So like you saved me again, you know?
Perfect.
You know? And also a good editor knows how to make you feel like it was your idea. So
let me ask you this. What was the most surprising thing you learned about John Candy while writing this book?
Well, the two surprises are that he had, you know, the main thing was that he really intended to be a dramatic actor and wanted to be a dramatic actor most of his life. And that the emotional intelligence that he brought to being a good actor probably gave him the information to be a good comedian. But that he also had it in reserve to be a great actor. And the times he did do dramatic roles such as JFK and Only the Lonely was, you could see it. And also the speeches in certain films within these comedies, like in Cool Runnings, there's a scene where he speaks about winning a medal and winning. If you're not fixed inside, you know, winning won't fix you. And the speech, you know, was written by someone else, but it could have been John Candy talking. And similarly, of course, the I Like Me scene in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles that John Hughes wrote for him. John Hughes at that point knew John Candy well enough to know the essence of John Candy, put it in the script, but Candy knew how to really knock it home, you know? And that was, you know, and there's other scenes in other movies where, even in Stripes, where John Candy sort of brings a certain truth to the acting of comedy roles. And I think he could have been a great, Oliver Stone says as much. He said he could have done a serious film. My contention is, I didn't put this in the book, but I thought of it later, which is if he'd been offered a film that did for him what Good Will Hunting did for Robin Williams, he might have won an Oscar. I mean, that's all, you know, you can't prove that stuff. But, you know, the same way that Robin Williams turned everyone's head by being suddenly a really great dramatic actor, Yeah. I think Candy could have done the same. But the other thing that I just want to say was a big surprise. It wasn't a big surprise, but it was a revelation. It's just how deeply hurt he was about body shaming. Considering he did take on roles where his size was the joke, but I realized that he had internalized a lot of this stuff. So his people pleasing tendencies were that he wouldn't let the public know how hurt he was about that stuff. And also, you know, the death of his father when he was only 5 years old, you know, things like that. So a lot of things that caught up with him towards the end, he would get panic attacks. I didn't realize he had actually had full-blown panic attacks and anxiety. And people described it to me when I was interviewing them. So people who worked for him would tell me about it. So it's stuff that nobody really saw. Backstage stuff at the Johnny Carson Tonight Show. You know, backstage, he said, is it too late? Can I cancel still? And he sweated through three shirts before he went on the air. And you don't think of him. He seems so confident in his movies and public appearances. So those are the two things that I guess the depth of the man surprised me. I knew he was a deep emotional guy, but I didn't know that he had a bit of a weight that he was carrying, an emotional weight besides the actual weight, you know. And I think that he held a lot of people up, and I think his shoulders started to hurt, you know, for holding everyone up, you know?
Yeah. One of the saddest parts of the book for me is that to read about all the projects that would have been made had John not passed. I mean, and they sounded like some great stuff was in the pipeline all the time.
Like Bartholomew versus Neff.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, if John Hughes had stayed on the project and if Sylvester Stallone had stayed on the project, John Candy would have made this film, an action comedy that was like a crossover of two genres, sort of like 48 Hours or something, or Beverly Hills Cop. It would have been something like that. And it might have been a whole new thing for all of those guys. Like, and then instead, because Candy was the last man attached to the contract with Carol Co Pictures, they put him on another film to play out his contract. And it was Wagons East. And that's the film he dies on. He dies making that film in the desert in Durango City, Mexico. And you think, wow, you know, maybe he would have done another thing and maybe he wouldn't have died. You know, I don't think the film killed him, but certainly being in high altitude in hot temperatures in Mexico didn't help him.
Right, you know? Exactly. Do you have a favorite John Candy line from one of his movies?
I think I was alluding to the speech about winning. From Cool Runnings, but really, I actually got the reprint rights to do the I Like Me, the entire paragraph from that, when he talks about I like me, my wife likes me, my customers like me, and what you see is what you get. Never has an actor had a line in a movie that is so, or a series of lines in a movie that are so a statement of who he is. And he delivers it. You can see a little bit of tearing up, but it's not fake. It's not fake Hollywood tears. And there's a look on his face that just, he almost goes pale. Like the actor goes pale on screen. And you never see that much. And, you know, and they cut away a couple of times to Steve Martin, who, I don't know what the sequence of the editing was, if it was real time, but the look on Martin's face too is like, you know, because his character is supposed to also be having a revelation about, oh my God, I've been pushing this guy and now he's breaking in front of me. Just that is such a, so that is kind of, after all I know about John now, or I think I know, that is, it feels like the most naked moment, and we can thank John Hughes for writing it, you know, so, and John Hughes loved him, you know, so that was, it was a great partnership.
Yeah. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is a high watermark for both Steve and John. They get to do comedy and drama all in this, just a fantastic holiday film. It's so good. I love it. Let's move on a little bit and talk about Record Store Day podcast. First episode dropped October 22nd, 2019. Your first guest was a big one, producer Tony Visconti. Currently 206 episodes.
It's amazing how, we've been doing it. Like, we weren't doing it every week at the beginning, but now in the last couple of years, it's been weekly. So there's an episode every week,
which means
I'm working a lot.
So now... Who's in charge of putting this podcast together? Do you have, or is Record Store Day people, are they telling you this is who your guest is going to be, or are you seeking out guests and figuring out the show?
Well, there's kind of a moving cast of, so let me explain first how the show came together. I had been doing podcast appearances on other people's podcasts. And I said, you know what? I actually feel really comfortable talking with people about culture and stuff. And it's really cool. You know, everybody was doing one. And I felt like, you know, Marc Maron was kind of a role model in terms of how to have a conversation on podcasts that didn't insult your own intelligence and or the listener. And I wanted to do one. And I was talking to Michael Kurtz, who, along with Carrie Colleton, founded Record Store Day, which is a consortium of independent record stores, by the way. People don't realize it's not just 2 days a year. It's an organization like a trade collective, protecting the idea of independent physical media stores. You know, that's and they started at a time when the very nature of record stores were going to go extinct unless they banded together to come up with some promotional means. And so one of the promotional means they had was to create this concept of Record Store Day, which in the beginning was only in April once a year.
Right.
Then they realized they could do special releases that could be part of that, so that stores had a reason to, people had a reason to go to these stores to get these limited edition releases. And then they had a second one for Black Friday in November. So they basically have two a year, but they make products, I hate to say product, but they make releases all year, and they work with all these different record companies. And now labels have these, if a release can only reach about 1500 copies, they can release a special release for Record Store Day. And then that means it's justified because it will sell out,
right?
You know, so the scale of that works out for everybody. So somewhere along there, Michael Kurtz, who's a really innovative guy and likes to get partnerships going, he said, Paul, why don't you do a podcast for us? So it's kind of sponsored by Record Store Day. And they had some sponsors as well that would, you know, pay for some of the costs. And, you know, I somehow got Tony Visconti, who is a social media friend, and I'm a huge Bowie fan. And I also loved his work with T-Rex and other people. But somehow I managed to get Tony Visconti for the first pilot episode. And just side note, Visconti recorded his end of the Zoom using the microphone he'd used on David Bowie's voice for Black Star.
Look up here, I'm in heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama, can't be stolen. Everybody knows me now.
Oh my
which
God.
Is like kind of amazing to me. And wow. he sent me the audio of so I didn't even use the Zoom audio. So it sounded like we were in the studio together. And anyway,
that's
so
amazing.
Yeah. So that just, and also he was so good. Like he was just so, you know, and I realized I really love doing this. And so they would say, you know, here's a record store that we'd love you to feature. And we don't do it as much as we used to, but we used to get a lot of record stores where we'd interview the store and ask them about their, you know, the manager of the store or the owner. And we still do it from time to time. And then they would also say, you know, we're getting some notices about this artist, and the label will provide you with the music and the artist. And so, but then I started to get contacts at all the people who do the publicity and the record companies. So they would just start directly marketing to me. And I would just, you know, some cases I will seek approval from the company because here's what happens. Some people go, hey, we want you to put this artist on and the album's only available in streaming. It's going to go straight to streaming, but you know, will you have them on? I'm like, well, no, the first rule is this has to be about physical right. records. It has to be available in record stores across the USA and Canada, but mostly USA. So I kind of field a lot of the offers. I have a lot of contacts. I also know a lot of musicians. Mm-hmm. So I will, you know, reach out to like my favorite Canadian band, Sloan. I'll reach out to Sloan and they say, hey, you haven't been on for a while. It's been 2 years. And you got a new album out. Why don't you come on and do a show? You know, or I'll request the group The Beths from New Zealand. That's an upcoming episode. The Beths, one of my favorite recent bands. And so I finally put an interview in the can that's coming soon.
One, two, three, four.
All right. I was thinking about something else.
Sometimes during Record Store Day season, they have a release that's coming out especially for Record Store Day. So, for instance, I don't know when this show we're talking on is airing, but
2 weeks. I think 2 weeks okay. It'll be out.
So, during the week leading up to Black Friday, we had Chris France from Talking Heads because they have a Talking Heads demo album that came out on Record Store Day Black Friday, and also on that episode, D Lights DJ Dimitri. Spoke to me about this greatest hits of D-Light, you know, the groove is in the heart, people. And so that was cool. And every so often I will put together a tribute to someone who's passed away. So that week, I think we had Jimmy Cliff and Manny from Stone Roses had passed away. So I do a little piece where I play some of their music and tell people to go to record stores and buy their back catalog, you know. So a lot of the show I can do myself, but I'm always getting good input from Carrie Colleton and Michael Kurtz. So it's, right. Yeah, so I'm answering at a very long, very, very, I hope everyone cared about that. I gave you a lot of these. That's the absolute honest truth about how it works. And I record it all here.
And this episode with Paul will drop on Thursday, December 4th. And Paul, after you record it, do you send it off or are you doing the post-production and uploading
it? I do the whole thing.
And you upload it?
I upload it to a server. Yeah, for sure.
All right, good.
Yeah. So the server is paid for by somebody else, but I, it's crazy, man. Like the amount of work I know. The good news. Well, there you go. Well, the good news is the I'll never have this level of artistic control in my life, but right. I record, edit and mix. And then I actually make the graphic that goes out on socials.
Wow.
Cause I have Photoshop skills and mad Photoshop skills, y'all. And then I get the official photograph from the record company so that I don't get those emails where they go, you use this crappy photograph. I get the one that they want. And, and I have it down to a system. You know, there's a bunch of templates I use for the show is on a template. So I can slot the interviews into an existing framework. The theme song's never changing or changes once every 3 years. It's a little more work than it would seem. Again, the dollar per hour ratio is not great, but it's fun. Where else would I get to talk to Ringo Starr 1 week or even Steve Perry from Journey? That was one where they came to me and like Steve got a Christmas album last year and it's like Steve Perry from Journey wants to talk to you. I'm like, yeah, let's do it. Yeah. The guy from The Sopranos last episode. Sure, let's do it.
Paul, this episode with you will be number 862. So I know.
Wow, I know what that feels like.
Oh my goodness.
Well, I don't know what that feels like. I can only imagine what that feels like. That's four times the amount. Four times the amount. Yeah, yeah.
By the way, how does it feel when you get the box of books sent to your house and you open up the box and see the book and hold it for the first time?
Oh, it's amazing. People do these unboxing videos and I finally did one this time. It really is fantastic, especially when it's in the hardback edition. Because there's something about a hardback edition, you know, we still have a bias. It's sort of like seeing a film in the theater rather than seeing it on streaming. There's something about holding it in your hand, flipping through the pages and seeing like the dedications. Yeah. You know, like I put a dedication to my wife, but also to my two brothers. And, you know, and it's just like just things like that where you see it in print. And like my wife's photograph on the inner sleeve, inner jacket is like the photograph she took of me, and I'm like, Lisa, look, they spelled your name right. And it's just a nice feeling of having it in your hand for sure. That never gets old. And I hope it never gets old.
I'm sure it will not. And yeah, cause it's Lisa with a Z.
Yeah. There's a whole story there. Her name's Elizabeth and we're from Canada. But she, that doesn't matter because she pronounced it Lisa as though it was an S. And, you know, first few years of getting to know her, it would be hard. Or when you're calling someone about a bill and it's the name on the account is her name, I'll say it. And so I'm in Canada when I was saying, I would be, okay, it's L-I-Z-A. And then I moved to America and I'd say L-I-Z-A. And they go, what was that third letter? And I go, oh, L-I-Z, sorry. So like, so there's lots of layers of, but I'll tell you something. It's been, we've been together since the 80s. So I'm, whatever adjustment I had to make, I made it years ago. So she's the best. So
let me ask you about the podcast again. Is one of the perks of doing that podcast, do they send you all the vinyl releases?
Well, here's the thing. I actually now, I will tell them, don't waste the postage on, like, it's no offense to, but like, I just, there's some records I don't need to have. Like, yeah. And so I do get things sent to me, like just recently got, like a little while back, Sarah McLachlan's new record and a Frank Sinatra record. But a lot of times I'll just say, like, just, you know, either send me the files for the show. That's one thing. I like to have the digital music on the show, just to play examples of. We only play clips, and then sometimes I'll get the CD or sometimes I'll get the vinyl, and the books too. Like we do talk about music books from time to time, like Bill Janovitz's book. I'll have them send me the book because that's a nice thing to have in the house. But there's a lot of books and CDs and records that I have to regift. You know.
Yeah,
and sometimes they end up in a local little library, you know.
Well, that's nice too.
Yeah.
And in doing it all these years, do you have a dream guest? Is there someone that you would really like to talk to?
Yeah, there's about three, and I can't ever think that these would happen. But Elton John, because he's a big record guy, and I know that I've heard him talk about records and record buying. And he's also always up on everything. Like it would be about his earliest purchases, but also the stuff he just picked up. And I'm sure he'd be a great hour-long episode if he could do it. And Paul McCartney.
Of course,
You know, the Holy Grail, the reason I got into songwriting, because I'm also a musician. And then Joni Mitchell. Again, I can't imagine the circumstances of getting Joni Mitchell on the show. Patti Smith, too. I had a conversation with Patti Smith for my book about Todd Rundgren, which I've blogged about. Patti Smith would be she's also a record nerd. Yes, the book of Wizard of True Star, Todd Rundgren in the studio. Patti did her interview for me in a Greenwich Village cafe, one-on-one across a table. And I was so nervous. But being in Greenwich Village, talking to Patti Smith is one of the moments of my life where you go, I don't know what I did to deserve this, but this is so great. And I remember walking, you know, there's cobblestone streets in that part of Greenwich Village. And I was walking through the streets afterwards and thinking, Bob Dylan walked on these cobblestone streets years ago. Like I just tapped into the history of New York City by talking to Patti Smith. And I'm not kidding, you know. And it's there are moments like that where, you know, so Patti would be a great guest on the show. That's definitely it. And then there's, you know, people who I'm surprised haven't been on the show yet. Like we keep talking about getting Brandi Carlile, for instance, who's like she'd been a Record Store Day ambassador. And for some reason, she always just gets really huge at the moment when I need her on the show. So,
right.
So, but the invitation is still open. She's a big record person too.
I feel like that Elton John one will happen for you because he releases a lot of stuff on Record Store Day. It always seems like there's an Elton release during Record Store Day.
I mean, I can tell you, like, the Record Store Day releases have been a really great gateway to talking to people like Don Letts, who used to do videos for The Clash, and Joe Strummer, and also Joe Strummer's widow. She was on the show. And, Danny Harrison, who I think we're friends. I don't know what he thinks, but by the end of it, I felt like we had a one-on-one conversation. And then not surprisingly, but I never thought Sean O'Lennon and I hit it off so well. Like I really felt this kinship with him. And we were talking about the film his parents did, One-on-One, about the one-to-one concerts. And he produced the whole thing. And just, you know, the circumstances of getting these people, I just like to be talking to Sean Lennon or Danny Harrison and having them be just great guys who just, you know, they do their own art, but they love their parents' work. It's just such a great, a unique moment.
Cool.
It's a unique twist in my life. You know, you wouldn't know that was going to happen if you told the 16-year-old me what's going to happen next, you know?
You know, I feel the same way when I've been able to sit, you know, across the table from, you know, Nancy Wilson or Rick Springfield, Sean Cassidy, any people that I've interviewed in person. I still get a kick out of it. That's why I still do this show. I do want to talk a little bit about A Wizard, A True Star, Todd Rundgren in the studio. I will tell everyone, go buy that John Candy book right now because you are going to love it. I love this book so much. I use this as a resource many, many times in my own podcast, especially chapter 18 on Cheap Trick's Next Position, Please, because Cheap Trick is my favorite band of all time.
Yeah.
What's your favorite album that Todd produced for another artist?
Oh, man. Well, I'm a huge XTC fan, so always Skylarking comes to mind.
I can't hold you down.
You know, I know my wife, her favorite record is Bat Out of Hell, Meatloaf. So, you know, and, you know, and you can't deny it was a great, it's certainly a record that everybody had in their home for a while there.
But you've been cold to me so long. I'm crying icicles instead of tears. And all I can do is keep on.
I love Wave, the Patti Smith group. You know, Dancing Barefoot is one of Patti's best recordings, I think. And, let's see what else. There's the first New York Dolls record, which I think is great. Yep.
Well, we can't take her this way, and her friends don't want another spring.
You know, I when I was a kid, I'm a huge Badfinger fan. So Straight Up by Badfinger. And also, I bought the single We're an American Band when I was a kid, and my first garage band played We're an American Band in Toronto, Canada. So learning how that record was made from the horse's mouth was pretty cool. That book was great too, because it was my idea. I said, you know, people don't know that Todd Rundgren, they know him as the guy who did Hello, It's Me, if they know him at all. Yeah. They know, maybe, you know, Bang on the Drum. And he's got so many classic records. He's also known as the guy from Utopia, sort of Prague. But when they don't realize that he also produced Meatloaf, New York Dolls, Patti Smith, XTC, Hall & Oates, the list does go on. I thought, I want to write a book about him just as a producer, where he's producing his own records, but also the records he did with the band, Stage Fright. I talked to Robbie Robertson for that. You know, like how cool is that? Levon wasn't well at the time I did the book, and I later learned that that's the only reason he didn't do an interview for me, was that he couldn't talk at that moment. He had a throat surgery at that, and then he later died, of course. But so what was great about that thing was it was my idea to make it a narrative about him as a producer artist. And, I think it kind of, it sold through, which is, they say, like, earned back its advance, but it's one of those books that is more influential, I think, than it actually was a bestseller, because people have it like you have it.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm honored and thank you that you have it. But I've seen people send me photographs of their recording studio, and they have it on the console. You know,
cool.
And they're showing me the photograph on purpose. You know, or you see it in someone's tour bus. You know, like, and so people who are in the business, people who make records, or people who are musicians, I wrote it for me. I wrote it for us. We're people who want to hear the liner notes. We want to hear people talking about how the sausage was made. And so I would love to do that again. In fact, there's a couple of artists I would love to do that with. One of them is Talking Heads. No one's ever written a book just about the way they made each of their records with Eno and all these people. I feel like that would be a book that's You know, the other one is, believe it or not, Jeff Lynne. I would love to do a book about Jeff Lynne where I do that. And Jeff Lynne's people have been reticent to share him with me. But because Jeff Lynne, similarly, you know him from ELO, but he also produced Full Moon Fever and the Threedles, the Beatles remake singles, right. You know? So there's a lot of Jeff Lynne stories that I think I want to tell, and you know, his work with also the Heartbreakers too. But you know, so there's this thing with the Todd book though. It's been so rewarding. It's like it kind of opened doors for me in a lot of other ways. In fact, it's kind of the reason I got the podcast, because I think Michael Kurtz is a huge Todd Rundgren fan. I think he told me that the reason he called me in the first place was to do liner notes for a Todd Rundgren reissue because he knew I would know. Record Store Day has hired me many years now to do many reissues and that got me working for Rhino Records, and there's a lot of good things came out of that Todd book.
And indeed they should, because it's just such a fantastic book. And when people don't know the albums that Todd produced and you just read that list, it's all over the map. Like musically, it's all over the place. I mean, Fanny, I mean, so many things that he's done. It's crazy. Yeah.
Fanny, one of the first all-women rock bands to be on a major label. I mean, they didn't get well-known beyond that, but David Bowie loved them, you know? Like, they left a mark. They left a mark with, and certainly other women acts like the Runaways and the Go-Go's, they would talk about Fanny as being, you know, women who showed them that women can rock. So Rundgren produced that record, you know, so it's kind of awesome.
I have a couple either or questions for you. And these are, if you're on a desert island, Paul, and you can only take one person's discography with you, are you ready?
Sure.
Is it Rundgren or Bowie?
Oh, dude. Can I just say I'd rather have food?
Okay.
Food and water.
For that one, if you can't choose.
So... You know, I love Rundgren, and he's become a friend of mine, but man, those Bowie records were so influential to me all through my life at various stages in my life. So I'm going to have to just pass on that question because I find it's too much of a Sophie's choice.
Let's do another. Badfinger or the Knack?
Badfinger.
All right.
No offense, Knack.
Ramones or the Clash?
Oh, dude, I love the Ramones. The Ramones were such a sonic assault, but the Clash were the songwriters. The Clash put new songs into the pantheon. The Ramones just had a new sound, but I don't want to say just about anything about the Ramones, because the Ramones were the sledgehammer that broke down the whole world, you know, and I still remember my brother Peter buying the first Ramones album and running up to he had his own bedroom. I shared one with my other brother. And Peter went up to his room, slammed the door, and all of a sudden you heard like, 1, 2, 3, 4. And like, you know, Gabba, Gabba, we accept you, one of us. And it was like the Ramones when I was still living at home, like Ramones were like an A-bomb gone off, you know? Yeah. And then at the same time, the Clash were the band that over the years I've just come to really, I really appreciate that, you know, Mick Jones and Joe Strummer, but like, and Topper Hedden, like there's everybody in that band had something interesting to do and left a mark on me in a different way. So, wow, you just throw the most difficult choices at me, man.
All right. Couple more, then I'm going to let you go and enjoy your day. What is your personal go-to Todd Rundgren album?
Ah, well, it's changed. But for many years, it was Hermit of Mink Hollow, because I could listen to every song cover to cover, and I just love them all. And it has ballads, but it also has rockers like Determination, and, you know, but also Can We Still Be Friends, you know. But then Something Anything was also the same thing, where it had everything. And then I kind of got into the Wizard of True Star. So lately, what I've been listening to, believe it or not, is Nearly Human.
Myself with the same old stick. I want to believe it so badly. I deceive myself, forgetting reality. Ignoring the fact that you're all together someplace else. Forgetting reality. But I swear I have now. The truth shall be.
an album that I don't know if everyone knows, but Nearly Human is right now I'm getting, because it was recorded live in the studio with a bunch of people. All the tracks are pretty much bed tracks recorded with like 15 people at once at Fantasy Studios in Berkeley, which is near me. And that record has so many great compositions on it that Todd was singing. It was 1980, was it nine or like, I have to look it up.
89. I think it's 89.
Yeah. And, but he's singing so well on the tracks, but the band is also playing so well. And it's such a great, I would almost say it's underrated, Nearly Human. So right now I've been on a Nearly Human kick, but Something, Anything and Hermit and Make Hollow have always been perennials for me.
All right. And this final one, if someone had never heard a Todd Rundgren song and you had to play one song, a gateway song for them to introduce them to Todd Rundgren, what song would you choose?
Oh, man. Couldn't I Just Tell You?
It's just, great choice.
Yeah. Or I Saw the Light, like one of those, something from,
just
from
tell
that.
You, though.
Yeah, Couldn't I Just Tell You has power pop. It has like the Who, but it also has the harmonies of the Beatles, and it's just, and the energy, and it's punk rock in its own way, like the old school idea of punk, like just a whining kid saying, you know, trying to break down the barriers of emotional confrontation with his partner or intended partner, and just there's something about that little moment of magic that he captured on that, you know.
Yeah. It's just, that's a perfect choice. I cannot argue that choice at all. Paul Myers is on Instagram at P-U-L Myers.
It's M-Y-E-A-R-S, like pull my ears, just so you know.
Oh.
It's P-U-L-M-Y. So it's pull my ears with one L.
Oh, you are right. And you would know because that's your account. Do you have a website? I couldn't locate one.
No, but lately I've been writing, for Substack. I've been doing my thing called the Paul Myers Overshare, and overshare is one word, okay. The Paul Myers Overshare on Substack, and it's Paul M-Y-E-R-S on in that occasion.
Okay. And Instagram is pull my ears, but with one L.
It's pull my ears with one L on most of the socials, frankly, okay. Including
Instagram.
That's
where you can find Paul. The book is called John Candy, A Life in Comedy. If you're listening right now, you can go get it right now. And I highly recommend that you do. In closing, Paul, I always ask my guests to choose a song that we use as our playout song. And for this episode, you can choose any song that means something to you, you know, over your entire life, whatever you want.
Well, in the theme of Hermit and Make Hollow, I guess it's because it's fresh in my mind, determination, because if there's anything that I've had to, there are lines when I remember the line, you're a new wave raver and you like to talk tough, but can you still cut the mustard when the going gets rough? Show me some determination.
Nice.
And I just had the occasion of hanging out with Todd Rundgren in San Francisco last week, and thanked him again for being so generous of letting me live in his house for a while in Hawaii to write the book, and what he taught me in his songs, and, you know, and just, and for the lessons he's showing me just by continually going out there on the road all these years later and still defining himself by his own terms, you know? And so determination, I would not have thought that when I woke up this morning, but after this conversation, I realized determination is a great song to go out on.
All right. Thank you so much for your time today, Paul Myers. Everyone, go buy John Candy, A Life in Comedy. And here we go. Here's determination. Take care, Paul.
Thank you so much for your kind words as well.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.